part of the Intro to Philosophy course, Professor required Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then Mere Christianity.
I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to another edition of All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. This is the second of a two-part episode where I had Dr. Charlie Starr and Dr. Crystal Downing share their views about how the 2005 Hollywood release of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe compares with the book that came out in 1950. I hope you had a chance to hear the first show. If not, there is a direct link in the show notes to it. On it, they provide, among other things, an excellent perspective of why it can be acceptable for movie adaptations to differ from a book. In fact, I'll share a couple of highlights from my guests about that before getting into new content for this show, which begins with a question about if they could remake The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or any of the Narnia movies, what would they do? It's worth noting that my conversation with them was recorded in early April 2020. So at some point, we should know more about what Netflix is doing with the rights they bought to produce Narnia films and or shows. One final thing. As I mentioned last time, there are a few occasions where the volume drops out briefly when either of my guests are answering. This was due to the imperfect nature of recording online, and I believe if you listen carefully during those parts, you can understand what is said. Well, with that said, here's some of what first Charlie Starr said about movie adaptations, followed by an excerpt from the last show about what Crystal Downing stated.
Things that I do expect from a film adaptation, the main elements of the plot to be present, a complete story arc for the main characters, both in terms of plot and character development. What I don't expect from a film adaptation of a book is that all the subplots will be present. Not all of the minor characters going to be there. And especially, I don't expect there to be lots of psychological exploration, which often takes place by the narrator, by the speaking of a narrator. And in film, though you can have narrators, they just don't talk as much as a narrator in a book might, and that's appropriate for film. That's how film operates.
An honest adaptation is a betrayal, and you can interpret that on two different levels. So an honest adaptation, in other words, if you tried to film every single moment in a novel and put it on a screen, it would be a horrible movie. You have to eliminate subplots. But also, the other interpretation of his statement, an honest adaptation is a betrayal, to make it honestly reflect the original source text, you have to betray various elements in the text. And part of this is because film is a visual medium versus novel. Obviously, we're just reading words on a page. So an essential element of a film adaptation is trying to figure out how do you externalize the internal.
If you were directing a remake of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe tomorrow, first, would you rather make a movie or something like a 5-episode show of the book? Why and how would you do it?
I feel like Peter Jackson saved his Lord of the Rings adaptations by making extended editions so that he could cover more material. Conversely, he ruined The Hobbit by adding too much material that wasn't in the text. And so I think Game of Thrones has shown the way. The multi-episode high-budget series for television. And so pursuing that with Netflix, as Douglas Gresham and the Lewis Company has been doing, I think has been the smart thing to do. I hope it ends up well. So I would start over with a $2 billion budget, and I'm not being hyperbolic there. I would start over with a $2 billion budget, a 7-year shoot schedule to which all actors were committed. I would start the whole process over again, making each book into a multi-episode Netflix series released in original publication order on a 7-year period.
Well, one of the things that Douglas Gresham told me that the people who had originally wanted to make The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, and this was the current president of Lucasfilm and her husband, in the late 90s, they had come up with a script and they wanted to set it in contemporary Los Angeles. Gresham, of course, did not like that idea. And I think for the first film, he's right. You need to acquaint viewers with C.S. Lewis's context. I think he helped create a superb first film. But if I was going to remake it, I would like to go back to that original script, because that is also a type of honest adaptation insofar as Lewis wrote a novel that reflected times he lived through. So how could we take Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe to reflect the times we have lived through? And what is especially exciting about this is that this original script that was produced in the late 90s started out with a helicopter flying over Los Angeles with a statue of Aslan hanging from the helicopter as you see it go over famous Los Angeles sites. And I was blown away when I heard that, because of course that is a quotation of the famous start Fellini's La Dolce Vita, which came out in 1960, where a helicopter is carrying a statue of Jesus Christ through Italy. And we see images of Christ as the shadow crosses the Colosseum and various sites, like Paul's Cathedral, various sites, until we finally see the statue dangling in front of a modern 1950s building. So good film quotes earlier film. It reminds me of the fact that when C.S. Lewis, and I forget now which Narnia Chronicle, but he has something that he calls the Parliament of Owls. And I still remember as a college student who loved the Narnia Chronicles, when I read Chaucer and discovered that Chaucer wrote a story called The Parliament of Owls. So Lewis was riffing off a famous work of literature, but you don't need to know that in order to appreciate the story itself. But the more educated you get, the more you realize the sophistication of certain elements Lewis added to children's stories. And so they had maintained this quotation from Fellini's movie. And there have been other, this is such a famous quotation that other movies have used it, like Goodbye Lenin, which shows a helicopter transporting a statue of Lenin over Berlin in 1989. I mean, the significance is obvious. And then there is a fantastic South American film called Even the Rain that shows a helicopter carrying an image of the cross through the countryside. So you have, since we've already done the more traditional style of film, to have something that moves us more to consider the artistry of film itself, I think is what I would like to use my gajillion dollars for.
Well, now, earlier we had you share specifically about your background related to movies. Let's have each of you talk briefly about other things you've published or might be working on.
My first book was on Dorothy Sayers, and all my books, as I mentioned earlier, have to do with what Christians can learn from critical theory, from post-structuralism. In fact, after my Sayers book, which is called Writing Performances: The Stages of Dorothy L. Sayers, I thought, oh, I want to write a book that is much more accessible, that explains why Christians need to familiarize themselves with postmodern theory. So I called that book, How Postmodernism Serves My Faith. And I basically, in a more accessible way, explain postmodern theory. And that book has been taught at seminaries. And my third book, then I wanted to get back to the what preceded postmodern theory, which is semiotic theory. Semiotics is the science of signs. And basically, I wanted to communicate why Christians need to take seriously semiotic theory. We need to be much more acquainted with and astutely critical of the signs that we use in order to communicate the faith. Christian truth does not change, but the signs we use to communicate it have to change. And that is basically my thesis. A great example, of course, is the sign indulgences. That was a beautiful idea in the medieval church that God indulges us. God does not hold us accountable for our sins. But the trouble is the word indulgence became corrupted by what Jacques Derrida calls an economy of exchange, where people were buying and selling indulgence papers. And so the very word itself became corrupted. So that then led me to my fourth book, because the one place where scholars are still actively discussing semiotic theory is in cinema. Semiotics, especially the semiotics of Charles Sanders Peirce, has revolutionized film theory. And what's interesting about Peirce is that he sees every sign as triadic. At one point, he actually said, it is as though the universe was created by a trinity. Oh, wow. Isn't that amazing? Oh, wow. So then the book that followed that, once I became co-director of the Wade Center at Wheaton College, which is the preeminent archive in the world for published and unpublished books, correspondence, papers, by and about C.S. Lewis and six of his influencers, which includes Dorothy Sayers, I felt I need to publish. And that, well, actually, I was invited to publish another book on Sayers, and that is coming out this fall. It is called Subversive, Christ, Culture, and the Shocking Dorothy L. Sayers. So that book, because it was, since a publisher reached out to me after I had written an article for Christianity Today and asked me for a book, I had to put my next book and The Wages of Cinema on hold, because if you have a bird in the hand, you want to follow through with it. So I wrote that book in about a year. And meanwhile, I have written more on film. I have a work on the relationship between art films about women painters that's going to be coming out in a Oxford University Press book called Theology and Film. So I've also completed that. And plus, I've written maybe 5-6 articles about Sayers since I took the job at the Wade. So the Wade job has kind of redirected my focus from film studies, which were all-consuming. I was a professor of English and film studies at Messiah College for around 20 years. So I will get this Sayers and Film book out, and then I'm just going to start exploring some of the other authors at Wade.
I love what you said about semiotics. I am so impressed with the need to understand. Well, this is one of the really significant things about C.S. Lewis, and I think it's what makes him different among evangelical thinkers of the 20th century, or if evangelical is not the right word, mere classical Christians of the 20th century, is that so much thought in regard to epistemology, how we approach truth, how we approach knowledge, in 20th century thinking was rooted in the Enlightenment rather than in Scripture, and in a true understanding of how imagination works as the meaning-making faculty in people. So this is what I love to write about all the time. I think the reason, for example, so much of Christian film is bad is because Christian filmmakers don't understand how truth works. They don't understand how knowledge works. They don't understand that imagination is significant. It has epistemological significance. So that means then for folks who don't like 50 Cent words, significance in terms of how we know the world around us and how we know truth. The imagination is key in teaching us things. It can teach us truth and it can teach us falsehood. But until we understand how imagination works, and ultimately I think that's what semiotics is about, we don't know what art is for. And we don't know how to use it effectively. So I love your thesis. I think it's dead on with everything Lewis has said, and it's very much what I tried to say in the Faith Without Film is Dull and some other works. So I guess then I should talk about what I've been working on. I've written two books on C.S. Lewis. In one, I was able to release a never-before-seen Lewis manuscript called Light, which is the final version of a story that Lewis wrote and that was published under the title The Man Born Blind. So in my book, I was able to release the Light story and then talk about its significance, especially in terms of the theory of knowledge, epistemology. And I was pleased to be able to publish that with the Man Born Blind version of the story so that folks could compare Lewis's writing process. And I was also pleased that the publisher was able to get Walter Hooper, Lewis's literary executor, to write the introduction to that book. The second book on Lewis I've written is called The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. And folks might remember that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, while Mr. Tumnus is fixing tea for Lucy, Lucy looks at his bookshelf and find four book titles, including Is Man a Myth? And Nymphs and Their Ways. And I use those four titles then as a launching point to study Lewis on creativity, but especially Lewis on myth. And I guess what pleases me most about that book is that as much as writers about Lewis have talked about his theory of myth, no one had yet written a book-length treatment of Lewis's theory of myth. So I was able to do that, and then I was able to get the wonderful writer and Lewis scholar Devin Brown to write the introduction for that book, and then to my embarrassment, left his name off of the cover of the book. So I am still in my heart paying the price for that little faux pas. But Devin's a wonderful, wonderful fellow. I just talked to him on the phone the other day, and he's got some neat projects that he's thinking about. And Devin's made some nice documentaries, by the way, going back to conversations about film. I wrote a children's fantasy for adults, too, which I called King Lesserlight's Crown. And that came out over a decade ago now. Two science fiction novels, The Heart of Light and The Darkening Time, which are part of a series that I'm wanting to continue to work on. I wrote a book on the Book of Romans, a kind of Christianity 101 through the first eight chapters of Romans. That book was called Life in the Spirit. It's the first book I ever wrote, first book I published. I also wrote a Bible book, which I'm really proud of because of the topic that it discussed. The book is called Honest to God, Wrestling Your Way to Intimacy with the Creator, and it is about wrestling with God. NAF Press put that book out. And the basic question is this: what do you do if you are a believer and you realize you have a problem and you realize your problem is God, whether that's through fear or anger, but especially anger? You have issues and your issues are with God himself. Is there anything you can do about that? And the answer is yes. And the Bible is filled with people who wrestled with God, and he loved them for it. And that book has been, writing it was comfort to me, and it's been a comfort to some folks who read it too. Lots of anthology chapters for a variety of subjects, anywhere from books about C.S. Lewis to pop culture studies, a chapter in a book on X-Men, on Halo, the game, one on King Kong, which was a whole lot of fun to write, Battlestar Galactica and so forth. Several short stories and some poems, a few of which have been published. I'm halfway through a book on Lewis and mass media. It was the book that I intended to write, but exactly as Crystal said, when opportunities came to write other books and a publisher actually wanted them, I set this one aside. So I could definitely give thought to going back to that. Most recently, I've been doing a lot of work on publishing and dating unpublished Lewis documents. Just this week, I got my copy of the journal Sehnsucht, in which appears an essay co-authored Bretton Dickinson, a wonderful Canadian Lewis scholar. And he and I have discovered the lost Archangel fragment, a sequel to the Screwtape Letters, which Lewis wanted to write but never felt he could. He did, however, attempt one single letter, one single paragraph, and we are publishing that for the first time in this new issue of Sehnsucht. I'm working on publishing some unpublished Lewis letters as well, and other documents, dating Lewis's undated poetry, and I'd like to continue to work on my science fiction series. But I want to do some searching about publishing to find a publishing source I think that might be more conducive to getting those books out, and maybe to re-releasing my children's book as well. That's everything for me.
Okay, well, both of you all have been quite busy over the last several decades, and have some great things ahead here. Now, just a couple more questions here as we close out the interview here. And the next one here is, you know, since this is the 70th anniversary of the book, you know, as well as the 15th for the movie, but thinking more in terms of the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, recall when C.S. Lewis handed you a copy. Well, okay, that was probably a dream, but but seriously, when did you first read the book, and what was your reaction to it?
It was the summer after my freshman year in college. I had bought the set, and I read the 7 books over a 3-week period, and I was absolutely overwhelmed by them. And I would say they changed my life. I wouldn't say they changed them that summer. They changed it that summer. But I would say they changed my life in the long run, especially on rereadings. But the first time I read the book was 1982. Summer of 1982, and I read that book and then followed with all the other ones right after.
I first encountered The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe in college. I had a philosophy professor. I went to a Christian college, and part of the intro to philosophy course, the professor required Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then Mere Christianity. And so I was struck at the time by the ability of this author. I had never heard of C.S. Lewis before I went off to college. I grew up in somewhat of a fundamentalist background and ran into other students at my college who would never have read C.S. Lewis because, after all, he drank beer and smoked cigarettes and was an Anglican. So I could legitimately read him since it was required in my philosophy class. And I was struck by his ability to both produce fiction and give cogent argumentation in their Christianity. And I think, and I said this on another podcast, the way Center has its own podcast, so we interview various people who come to do research at the Wade Center. I am struck by the fact that Lewis has both a philosophy degree and a literary degree. And I think that's what has made him such a fertile author.
Well, then for a final wrap-up here question, back to the movie adaptations. Give us a summary of your thoughts about them, whether it be, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, good, the bad, however you want to summarize.
I think that The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe is a superb example of filmmaking in the classical Hollywood style. I think it is an excellent way to intrigue both children and adults. And I think an effective children's movie is one that can appeal to multiple age ranges like that. But what we would hope the response would be is children want to read more of the Narnia Chronicles and their parents want to read them with their children. It reminds me of something that Charlie said earlier about the problem, cheesy, poorly made evangelistic film. And I talk about this in my upcoming book, The Wages of Cinema. Dorothy Sayers made a great statement that I think should guide all people, all Christians who want to make film. And I think this was fulfilled by The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Dorothy Sayers said, "The only Christian work is good work well done."
She's right. You know, I had a revelation about adaptation sometime in the middle of the first decade of this century. I was teaching with some colleagues and we were doing short stories. We read a short story written by James Joyce called The Dead. And we watched the film that goes with that short story. It was a film made by the famous Hollywood actor and director, John Huston. It was the last film he made. It was called The Dead. It was an adaptation of the short story. And it actually starred his daughter, Angelica Huston. And it was an absolutely faithful adaptation of the story that was an hour and 45 minutes long. And that's when I realized that you can make a 2-hour film for a short story and cover the entire short story, but you cannot do that with a novel. Think about how long it takes to read a novel, 15, 20 hours. If you're going to turn that into film, you're going to have to do some compressing. There's going to have to be some transposing to again, use Lewis's term, transposition. But again, it made the idea hit home with me that if a film is going to adapt a book, it has to adapt the book. There has to be this thing called adaptation occurring. Before The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe film came out, I had a really good feeling about it because of what Walden Media had done up to that point. Walden Media had made as their central credo the idea that they wanted to take classic children's books, excellent books of literature, and faithfully adapt them. So they had done that, for example, with their first movie, Holes, which I thought was terrific and a terrific adaptation. So I was hopeful that they would do that with The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. And what you get then is a high-quality film, an A-list film, an adventure epic, which I think is a faithful adaptation. It may be that Lewis Marcos is right and that there's too much focus on the decisions that the kids make and on their actions and not enough on Aslan's sacrifice. But I thought it a very faithful adaptation, and I didn't notice what Marcos had suggested was a potential flaw. So if it is there, it in no way ruins the film. I do wish Walden Media had kept their credo in making the next two Narnia films. But I find The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to be a good movie and a successful adaptation.
All right. Well, that's a good place to close. Thanks goes out to Charlie Starr and Crystal Downing for being my guest today. I trust the listener here has been informed and has some great good thoughts to reflect on. And so when you go back and not only just watch the movie, but also read the book, you can consider some of the things that they've said. And I hope you have been enriched by that. All that's left to do then is for me to thank my guest, Charlie Starr and Crystal Downing. Thanks again for being on All About Jack.
Glad to be.
It was a delight. Thank you for inviting me, William.
Thanks also goes to you, the listener, for investing your time to hear what my guest had to say. As noted at the start of the show, I hope you had a chance to listen to the first part of my interview where my guest spoke more directly about their opinions on the 2005 movie adaptation of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in comparison to the book. If not, you can check the show notes for a direct link to that episode. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host, and you've been listening to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, which is a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I've also recently begun a short YouTube channel entitled 90 Seconds to Knowing C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to that. My guests today were Dr. Crystal Downing, co-director of the Marinead Waite Center at Wheaton College, and Dr. Charlie Starr, who teaches at AB University in Philippi, West Virginia. Also in the show notes are some of the books they have published. Additionally, Charlie has been a guest several times, so there will be a link to at least some of his past appearances. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is All About Jack at podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. See the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it more easily. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.